My name is Jody Kretzmann, and I'm here with Walter Altman and with John Yoder. We're going to be talking about violence and nonviolence tonight. Ever since Ingrid and I began to think about who was going to be up here when this summer, an evening like this has been on my mind. When I saw that John and Walter were going to be overlapping each other for a week here, it seems to me that that and precisely at that moment, it occurred to me that one of the most important discussions that we could possibly engage in was sort of ready-made for us. And so we want to get into that tonight, and not, again, necessarily solve all of the complicated questions around violence and nonviolence tonight, but to at least open the discussion and do it early enough in the week when John and Walter will continue to be here, so that we continue in dialogue for the rest of the week as well. We couldn't have two better people to lead us into these ruminations. I've asked each of them to open with 6 or 8 minutes of summary about issues which really have engaged each of them, I think, for much of their lives. And it's not, I feel a little chagrined at asking anybody to summarize their position on issues that have occupied him for that long. John Yoder, as you all know, is a theology professor from the University of Notre Dame at this point. Let me say autobiographically that John's writings have been highly influential in my life and in the lives of other people who were draft resistors during the Vietnam War along with me, and has challenged continually, particularly with his marvelous book, The Politics of Jesus, my own understanding of what Jesus was about. At the same time, Walter Altman and the development of liberation theology in Latin America in particular, it seems to me, has spurred all of us in North America and should continue to spur all of us to think about the mandate which can be organized now within a Christian context for radical change towards God's justice within society. The polarities here, if they are polarities, are ones, it seemed to me, which determine an awful lot about the moral direction of our lives in the late 20th century. And for me, anyway, it's most exciting to be able to think about these issues with people like John and Walter to lead us into those questions. So, with no further ado, let's see how they summarize their lives in 6 minutes. And I'll give them each a chance then to respond to the other's opening statement, and then let's open it up for some dialogue with them and for your own additions to the conversation. We have no decision up here about who's going to go first. Alphabetical, but by first or last name. Altman, you're immediately here. Walter, why don't you begin?
Well, okay. Let me start, perhaps, trying to undo some possible expectations that you might have. Could be, for example, that putting us two here together, you are expecting me to be a very strong advocate of the use of violence.
I'll just move away.
And I hope that's not totally the case. And the other thing is that since I've been teaching on liberation theology and being presented as a liberation theologian, very often liberation theology is kind of understood in a sense that is kind of equated to the use of violence. So I met many people who kind of think, oh, liberation theology, so that's the advocacy of the use of violence. And let me say very briefly that is a very strong misunderstanding of what liberation theology is about. The issue of the use of violence or not use of violence does arise in a particular section of liberation theology as it has arisen in the theological considerations of all times, but is not the essence of what liberation theology is about. In fact, if you take liberation theologians from Latin America today, you will have those who do think that in certain given situations the use of revolutionary violence would be an acceptable last resort, and you have others who stress that that liberation theology, because of the essence of liberation theology and having Jesus Christ at the very center, and Jesus Christ not having used violence for political, social purposes, therefore the followers of Jesus should not either. One person who has always supported liberation theology, very well known of you, Archbishop Elder Câmara from northeastern Brazil, is a very committed non-violent theologian and bishop, and has in fact talked about the issue, saying that there is a certain spiral of violence going on in society, and he did call the what he mentioned, the institutionalized violence in Latin American societies, as the first violence which is given in our societies, and so did understand that there could be a possibility of a secondary violence as in response to that institutionalized violence. But nevertheless, he says, that just brings about a spiral of violence, because it, again, in the attempt of, through violent means, to overcome institutionalized violence, you provoke even more violence by the system, repression, and so the spiral will go on, and then you say, well, we have more reasons to counter with revolutionary violence to the institutionalized violence, and the spiral will move on and on, and that it is indispensable that we break that spiral of violence, and that precisely the followers of Jesus should be the ones who would break that spiral of violence. And therefore liberation cannot be attained through violent means. Well, so that's one trend within liberation theology. Then, before focusing the other one, I would like to say that the kind of violence we are then contemplating and talking about now is the question of the violence as a possible means of trying to reach a goal which is assumed to be good, let's say a better society. A less violent society would be the goal. A society that would be respectful to human beings. A society in which people would participate, which therefore democratic values of participation, organization of the people, basic human needs being met, and so on. That's a kind of a goal, but because of the existing violence in the system, can at a given moment, is it allowed at a given moment for Christians and liberation theology in that case to espouse the necessity of revolutionary violence? Well, some theologians do think that would, as a last resort in given situations, be permissible. But let me say that is not a principle of violence. So that's not a question of a principle. You could, I would understand and accept, and in given situations even admire, an option for nonviolence in principle, because any violence would be a denial of the fundamental values, for example, of life. When we are talking about violence, we are ultimately talking about the possibility of killing other people. So that would deny fundamental value of life. So I can understand and accept and in given cases admire a principle of nonviolence. But a principle of the use of violence, as there is in certain forms of revolutionary ideologies, in a certain type of Marxist vision, I cannot accept in no way, and as much as I understand liberation theologians, they are espousing that. I mean a kind of view of the society and of the possible transformation of society that would say, well, the conflicts within society, the systems of exploitation and oppression systems established, and the institutionalized violence, the dominant classes using violence and so on, they are of such nature that somewhere along the line, if you want to change really radically that society, you know already that you will have to use revolutionary violence. So the contradictions within society, they will become sharper and sharper, and it will get to a point inevitably where you will have to use revolutionary violence. So that's the use of violence as a principle, even if it has the goal of overcoming situations of violence and then establishing a better society, or in Marxist terminology, then a classless society or something like that. So that's not at all what I would be talking about. But I do think that there are, in given realities, in society, in history, situations in which you are caught in the dilemma, which might lead you as a last resort to the use of violence. And I would recall Dietrich Bonhoeffer this moment from our Lutheran tradition. During the Nazi regime, he, after a long period of reflection and so on, he came to the point where he got involved in a group which was trying to murder Hitler, because he came to the conclusion that if they would succeed in that, there would be a good chance that they would be saving millions of lives. And there was a mad person leading millions and millions of people to death. So, in a certain sense of a lesser evil, participating in that sinful situation, he dared to enter into such a process. And I think there are also some other situations, society, I think specifically in Third World today, where something analogous, perhaps even broader in scope, is happening. And so that the question, as I see it, is not resolved in principle, but is resolved in the midst of the situation. And rather than making a theory out of it, and I think I probably spoke too much already, I would like just to give two examples of how that might happen. The first one I told the other day in one of my sessions, both of them actually come out from Nicaragua. The first one, when I was there in 1980, first time, twice I was in Nicaragua, just 1 year after the Sandinista took over, so the memories of the people were all the revolutionary struggle and against the Somoza dictatorship and so on. I went on a Sunday to the Baptist church, and after service, talking with some people, and then one person, one man, told to me, I had asked him about how he felt as a Christian
the whole situation and the use of violence and so on. And he then told me the story, said, well, I have seven sons. And for a while during the Somoza regime, at the last years of the Somoza, they were kind of between 20 and 13. They were asking to join the guerrillas, the Sandinista, against the Somoza. And I kept telling them, that's not permissible for us as Christians. We use only peaceful means and so on. And, well, the conversation went on and said, quite often the sons were asking for permission and he kept telling that that's not permissible. And then at one evening after devotion, he said, we listened to a discourse by a speech by Somoza, the dictator. He had been urged to leave the country to avoid a greater death toll. And he was speaking, and he, at a given moment, he said, well, I won't leave the country even if the youth of this country in the totality has to die, but I won't leave the country. And then the family around the table discussed, and the father said, well, if we have such a dictator that he is going to take the whole youth of the country to death, then you have my permission and you may join the guerrillas. And then he paused a little while and then he added and said, well, today I have six sons, but they live in a free country. The other example which I would like to give was also by a Baptist theologian of the seminary in Managua. He took me around the country to different cities and we had long time for conversation. And he told me, well, at the time of the Sandinista revolution, even then I stayed non-violent. I could not make use of violence. So all my sympathies and so were with the Sandinistas and what they represented against Somoza, but I cannot use violence. So I helped. I received some people who were needing medical care out of the Sandinistas. They were hidden in my home. I tried to give support in that way, but I could not use violence. But now, that was 84, when they were pretty much afraid that the United States would intervene militarily. Said, we have a free country, and if the United States is going to intervene militarily in our country, I have no choice anymore. I will have to take up arms and fight against those who are going to invade my country. Mm-hmm. So those two examples, I think, show what for me is important, that I think the decision is taken in the midst of very dramatic situations, and not from outside theoretically in principle.
And somewhat different, one under an established authority and the other guerrilla situation. So we have dub violence as a last resort under very limited conditions, very situational, a kind of what John would call part of the strand of the just war theory.
Well, yes, I think some of the points which he has made on the conditions of just war probably are also applicable to a revolutionary violence. So,
all right, thank you. John, lead us further into whatever direction you'd like to at this point.
Well, I won't try to do my life story in 6 minutes. my role in dealing with this kind of question is usually that of historian explaining where things came from in their variety, or the ecumenical moderator trying to get terms so defined that people who use the same term can be talking about the same thing, which very often doesn't happen in ecumenical. So I'll concentrate my first comments on the level of definitions and explanations rather than so much argument. First, I'm grateful that Walter took my first speech in warning that liberation theology is not when it arises in a situation where liberation has to be talked about, whether that be Latin America or Black Africa or some other setting of injustice, it is not a priori naturally an argument in favor of machine guns. Any theology is a theology of liberation which perceives that the human predicament is one of unfreedom, and that God intervenes to deal with that unfreedom. I considered it not only true, but also a compliment when I was introduced myself at Princeton University by the then president, saying that my Politics of Jesus is a book of liberation theology. I think it is, because it defines what God is about in terms of real social relationships of power and empowerment rather than something else. When it arises that, whether in Latin America or Black Africa or somewhere else, someone talking about liberation also talks about violent political revolution, that is the mainstream of Western political thought. That's what Oliver Cromwell did in the 17th century. That's what Thomas Paine and Benjamin Franklin did in the 18th century. That is what 20 revolutionary regimes did all over the Americas in the 19th century. To say that an uprising may legitimately use violence against an established government which is held to be illegitimate, that is not Latin American or Black African at all. That is mainstream European theology applied to the political realm since the 16th century. That doesn't say it's either right or wrong. We shouldn't act as if it were something novel or threatening because it comes from South America. That's what Thomas Jefferson believed. So that we have to place it for ecumenical evaluation in a setting where it isn't thought that only people who talk about God's purpose being liberation and empowerment are people who justify violence. No, most Christians since the 4th century have justified violence. And they've done it in various ways, which I talked about a little in my lecture hour. Sometimes they do it with no restraint at all. Sometimes they do it with joy because they believe that God loves it. One case that we didn't talk about before, but it's appropriate to mention here, Sylvester Stallone does it just for kicks. And we pay him millions of dollars for it because that indulges our taste for the vicarious macho power that none of us have, but we all kind of wish we could have. So we'll pay Sylvester Stallone and make him a millionaire doing it for us. That has its place in the discussion of the third world in the heritage of Frantz Fanon, a Black African psychiatrist working in Algeria at the time of the Algerian War, who said that it is right to kill people if I am the slave. It's right to kill the women and children of my oppressor because that gives me psychic liberation. Well, that's more like Rambo than it is like justifiable political violence. But there is some of that in the ideologies of violence. I need, if I'm a slave, if I'm a Black African or an Algerian, the act of killing a white person proves to me my manhood. Fanon was a psychotherapist. He was talking about those Freudian terms. Well, obviously you can't make sense out of that in terms of either political effectiveness or Christian morality. But you can make sense out of last resort, careful, limited, local recourse to violence for a particular political purpose. And then it is a translation of the just war tradition into that setting in which you ask questions about likely success, etc. And that's the conversation that would have to be carried on at greater length, looking, for instance, at these cases. But first, I need to say what I was going to say by way of introduction. First is to point to the great difficulty in getting a firm definition of what the word violence itself means. We all have our common sense understanding of what it means, but if you look closer at the word, it's less clear that the word all by itself carries any one particular definition. We talk about a violent color clash. We can talk about a violent style of speech. A violent type of personality. And as we'll see in a minute, redefinitions of the word are part of the conversation that we need to talk about. It differs from much of our language in that the noun violence is based on a verb, to violate. To violate is a transitive verb. That is, you don't just violate, you violate something. There's always an object to violate. You may violate a law. You may violate a frontier. You may violate a person's physical integrity. In French, Spanish, and Portuguese, the verb to violate is the ordinary verb for rape. That is, there is some kind of limit, some integrity, some value, and you destroy it, or at least you destroy its wholeness. That's what you're doing when you're violating. You violate something, some value. If that value happens to be an evil thing, then to violate it might be a good thing. So Martin Luther King could claim to reach all the way back to Thomas Aquinas, saying that you ought to violate an unjust law. That's a form of violence against the rules, against custom, that is morally proper, or even in certain settings, morally imperative. Father Camara, who has, the one already said, himself committed to nonviolence in the ordinary sense of the term, has written a book about the violence of the poor, by which he doesn't mean that they throw stones or shoot people, but that there's a quality of commitment and discipline accessible to the underdog in a culture, especially in the spirituality of the type that he represents, that is powerful. There's a partly Calvinist, partly Catholic monastery in southern France, in Dizé, the prior of which has written a book also using the word violence in a good sense, by which he again doesn't mean killing anybody or oppressing anybody, but profound commitment and self-discipline, taking something very seriously. So the word does have all kinds of meanings, and we have to settle down to which ones we're talking about. As many analysts of the Third World have begun saying, there's something that we have to call morally violent about a perfectly peaceable situation, if it is unjust in its structures. There's no guns, no disorder. If in a Brazilian slum the child mortality rate is 10 times as much as it is down the road in an upper middle class community, you don't need any guns, you don't need any disorder, those babies are just as dead as if they've been shot. So institutional settings or structures may be the moral equivalent of violence, even though nobody sets apart to carry on a war. And that has to be part of the picture. And as Camara says, that's where it starts. I mean, it is to respond to something that violates human dignity without anybody taking the gun, that other people say we need to respond with insurrection violence. And then, as Walter said, Camara says, I understand why you think you have to do it. I understand the nobility of people who go off and do it, but it's wrong because it only makes things worse. Then we have the whole realm in Western history that doesn't even get talked about in this distinction between, or this juxtaposition between structured violence, like high infant mortality due to social injustice, and revolutionary violence. And that is the legitimate violence according to the rules, that is the guns of the policeman, or the death penalty, or prisons. Those are forms of violation of human dignity that are perfectly all right according to the laws, and according to Martin Luther, and the Pope, and most moral authorities in Western tradition. So all of that has to be on the scene somehow if you're deciding how to evaluate morally one particular way of putting pressure on the situation. all of that attention to the variety of definitions does not intend to resolve anything, but just to make us aware how messy it is to try to make judgments on what's going on as a fact before we decide on what it means morally. And one of the more striking recent experiences is the clarity with which we have, in the past 6 months, been seeing people talk about the disorders on the West Bank in Jordan as violence when it's teenagers throwing stones at tanks. Only by the rarest accident will that ever be lethal. Practically always, the kid out in the street exposes himself to far more damage than he's doing to anybody. He doesn't even think he's doing damage to anybody. It's a gesture. It's been said in some of the careful journalism that on the spectrum, throwing stones in a West Bank city street is more like nonviolence than it is like war. And that the Israelis respond with regular military preparation and give their young men training crowd control techniques, which is send them off with the skills it takes to fight a war. So, what is really violent in the sense that those who are offended by it and say it's proper to respond by violence is debatably different every time. The other introductory thing I want to say is that when we construct a negative abstract verbal noun, non-violence, there's something even more complicated going on. To violate is itself to negate. Not to violate is therefore to affirm in some kind of a backhanded way. So that for the word nonviolence to mean something, it can't be just a double negative. It has to be some kind of a commitment to the integrity of that which one does not violate. So either a commitment to not harming a person or commitment to not breaking the law. And that commitment then means more than just a negative principle. Affirmation of the worth of the party in the relationship, especially the adversary in a conflict relationship, that needs to be explained. Why am I committed to the dignity of my adversary rather than trying to destroy him? And how does that commitment to the dignity of the adversary operate in the relationship? The most appropriate and substantial use of the noun nonviolence really in the last 20 years has been as a code cipher or abbreviation for nonviolent direct action, by which is meant not doing something violent, but doing something aggressive that is nonviolent in the sense that it doesn't kill people. And in that narrower definition, then we look at the Gandhi story and the King story and other less widely known experiences like that, where it is possible. Precisely in favor of the underdog. You can't do it very well in favor of oppression. But in favor of subject peoples and victimized peoples, to empower them by finding forms of discipline that permit them to resist evil as they couldn't do if they had to do it with guns. And sometimes that works and sometimes it doesn't work. At least sometimes it works. And once it had been brought to our consciousness in the modern world that sometimes it works, and sometimes there are modes of struggle that are not lethal. And in fact, in sometimes and places, for some discernible reason that a social scientist can explain, they are more effective because they commit themselves not to be lethal. Like what Martin Luther King did. I mean, if his people had gone out in the streets of Birmingham with guns, they would have been absolutely and immediately counterproductive. Was because they went out unarmed that it worked. And in that sense, once one knows that nonviolent means can sometimes achieve certain things, then, to ask the post-war question, you're not in a situation of last resort until you've tried them. If you would try them, you would find that you have more options than if you didn't think of those options. This is something that is now being developed in considerable bulk in the political science schools and laboratories of the land. Gene Sharp is the author of a Harvard dissertation on nonviolent action, who said specifically after the effective takeover of power 2 years ago in Manila, that something like that transition happened without much premeditation, without much training, without contingency planning, without developing of skills, without developing of cadres. You can't have a war, whether a guerrilla war or a out-and-out professional war, without enormous investment in training and weaponry and contingency plans. If anything like that were done, then the potential for success of nonviolent techniques would be much greater than the kind of minimal success that was obtained in the Manila event. The Manila event is disappointing now, 2 years later, precisely because it thought, as many revolutionary people think, that if you take power, you've won. Whereas in fact, if you take power in an unmanageable situation, you're probably worse off than before. Which is why nobody wants to run for president this fall. So the Aquino victory was not a successful cure for what was wrong with the Philippines, but it was a demonstration that it was possible for a major power transition to take place when the people that make the most difference are the ones that are committed not to shedding blood, to not shedding blood. So nonviolence as a code word doesn't mean doing nothing. It doesn't mean just saying we won't shoot. It means finding modes of conflict which can be illuminated and nourished by the experience of some cases and some settings, which actually do what one ought to be involved in doing in favor of the underdogs and against oppression. Now, what you can do in particular cases, that does have to be described always situationally. If you haven't looked, then you can't say there are no options. And usually we don't look. Usually one says there are no options, one hasn't looked. Ronald Reagan said that we had to bomb Tripoli because it was a matter of last resort. We can very easily say last resort when we haven't really tried anything else. And Gene Sharp points out, really, to try anything else, you have to invest in it the way you invest in preparation for war or you invest in preparation for guerrilla violence. Enough to...
All right. All right.
Vocabulary.
A set of distinctions on violence, a set of distinctions about nonviolence, a reminder to us all that we're not in a position where we're thinking about opting out of conflict, that conflict is a given in these situations, and that we're talking about ways in which to engage conflict in different modes and with different values underlying. Walter, do you have any quick response to anything John said? Then we'll open it up.
No, I think probably better if we open up the
Let's do it.
Floor.
Questions, comments, alternative positions, cases for people to comment on, other modes of interjecting.
Question.
Gary, come on in.
I guess I'd like to ask you, if I think you stated very clearly that what your concern is about the last resort, and the fact is that in many or maybe even most situations where violence is used, that people haven't really trained and tried non-violent methods. I guess my question would then be, can you think of a time, is there an example in history, or are you willing to conceive the possibility that there may be a particular situation in which people who really have tried very committedly nonviolent means would then at some point have to resort to violence as a last resort, or do you see that as sort of morally untenable?
Or do you take the just war theory yourself?
Well, I use the just war language in conversing with people of integrity who are not pacifists, which is most of the people in the world. I mean, most of the people in the world are not pacifists. How many of them have integrity? We'll see in the conversation. So that the question of last resort always has to be asked. That doesn't mean that I have bought into all of the pragmatism and the short-range statement of the goals that we have to attain that that last resort discussion presupposes. That I still have to ask the other question. What is a just authority? What cause justifies this much damage? What is the proportion of damage? All the rest of the just war conversation belongs to, not only last resort. If we are to be careful with that mode of moral reasoning. But I can certainly find in history many cases where, because nobody ever looked, nobody ever found an alternative. In fact, that's why we have most wars. I can imagine some cases where I couldn't come up with an alternative if I were just parachuted in the situation and people said, hey, now what do we do now? But that's the nature of the case. That really can't be asked. A specimen of this, the clash between different kinds of moral reasoning is wrong when it supposes that someone who says that is wrong to do it always has to have another solution. Sometimes that's an appropriate counter-challenge and sometimes it isn't. If I were a skiing instructor and gave clear orders to somebody who's learning to ski but not yet expert not to go down a certain slope, and they started down anyway and said, now teacher, what do I do? I wouldn't owe them an answer. Because they set things up on the basis of the denial of what I had told them. And that's the case in most of the ecumenical conversation about needing violence. People don't give nonviolence a chance, and then they say it doesn't work. They try violence, and they don't draw the conclusion when it doesn't work. So if we're doing ecumenical argument, I have to ask for an even playing field. Rather than thinking that nonviolent techniques ought to be able to promise to save all kinds of causes, worthy and unworthy. Now, King and Gandhi were clear, you can only use nonviolence for a good cause. You can't use it for most causes. And you can't use it for the defense of oppression. So that all the picture needs to be discussed before we've finished figuring out whether an ethical stance that talks about Jesus as model, and an ethical stance that talks about personal integrity and living up to one's conscience, and an ethic that talks about taking responsibility for the course of events, can meet or whether they clash. As far as I can tell, one that talks about Jesus will cover the most of my life with the most clarity, because the closer I look at pragmatic responsibility for the course of events, the less honesty I find in the people who argue that. I also have respect for someone who has to make their decision on the basis of personal conscience and integrity. But that you can't discuss that ecumenically, because everybody has his own viscera. So that there is no one response to your challenge that discusses all the conversations at the same time. I have to accept pragmatic discussion as what most people want to talk most of the time. And if, when I'm doing philosophical ethics, I have to say that pragmatism is not ultimately a basis for making important decisions in a world where the right thing to do for the best man that was ever here was to get crucified.
Others? Where are you on these questions? We're getting an active and aggressive nonviolence described, clearly, right? There may be some other forms.
One thing that would help me would be, could you elaborate from your perspective, Mr. Yoder, what you could imagine have been some alternatives used, let's say, by in the situation immediately prior to World War II, that probably weren't explored. I recognize that it's impossible to look back on something that took place, but and maybe this is an impossible for instance, but it would be helpful for me just to hear someone imagine it, because I know there are a few isolated instances, I think in, was it Bulgaria or something, where a bishop said, no Jews go out of here or I'm going to lay down in front of the train, and people support him, and no Jews were trained. It was one of those countries, and that was probably the only place where there was a massive, but I know they're real isolated. Is that a question you can...
Well, it's the question that I can't disregard, but neither can I grant that it's possible to expect an answer to it.
Yeah.
So within the frame of reference of American isolationism and American nationalism in the 1930s, within the frame of reference of the way the French wanted to beat Germany down after the First World War, and everything else that set up the world for the Second World War, not enough people are asking me for guidance that my hypothesis can become pertinent in that kind of setting. It's more appropriate to ask, would the just war theory, which most of you say you hold to, if you're Lutherans, have provided guidance if it had been looked at? Would there have been a bombing of Hamburg? Couldn't have been. And yet we did it and none of you stopped it. Would there have been an insistence on unconditional surrender, which is counter to the just war tradition and to international law? Well, we did that. And that made the Germans hang on longer, that made the war worse, and it made it harder to set up a new Germany that was violent. So I would challenge the people who aren't pacifists to take responsibility for applying the just war criteria to what the nation has done, rather than asking how, if everyone had been pacifist, they would still have won the war. Now, if everyone had had pacifist convictions, we would have had a different Woodrow Wilson. Things would have been drawn different from way back there. And that is very hypothetical. But that states well, that poses well, the problem of what we're doing when we try to talk ethics. Are we talking how to get away with running the world, or are we talking about how to be proclaiming in the world that Christ is Lord? And we have two different sets of criteria for whether you've done that, depending on which of those you're trying to do.
You know, it's fascinating to me to listen to both of you asking for, I think, both of you asking for a serious application of the just war theory. Mm-hmm. A serious application of those criteria, under which 95% of the wars that we engage in would probably not be permissible, right? And then you might deviate a little bit, on the other 5%.
That's my question. Has there ever been a just war? I mean, where everybody agreed to the rules you talk about, and has there ever been?
Hardly perfectly. I would think that we could grant, and for purposes of debate, I would want to grant that it's not an impossible concept, and that there may have been cases that came close. That is, I would think that the Catholic bishops were right who said that the independence movement in Zimbabwe was legitimate, that the Smith regime was not, or that the Sandinista movement was, at least at the end, when the Catholic Church themselves said that the Somoza regime is illegitimate. Once you have an absolutely illegitimate regime, that's one of the major factors that determines that you can call it a justifiable war. And there were commitments on the part of the Sandinista to national reconciliation after a victory. And I could hypothetically say that certain wars can be recognized as meeting these criteria, if it's not utopian to ask those questions of real wars. I doubt that they ever really do, but they could. And the fact that they don't is not because people are human, but because people choose not to obey their own moral commitments.
I would like to call the attention that these are processes which take place, and that they, in history, only seldomly will kind of derive of certain ideas that people or whole society has, but the situations evolve from one to the other, and the options start to be played by ones and others. So that might be one point that would be a certain disagreement between us. I think that very many revolutions which used violence along the process did not start that way at all. So they started with many other means. You could always argue, well, they didn't try all what they could, so it was not the last resort. In that sense, perhaps the last resort is really something hypothetical, because you could try again something else, and perhaps at the second time it would work, even if it didn't work the first one, and so on. But I think in many, many cases there is a certain process. I do know that there can be the opposite, especially if you have a certain type of absolute ideology that you will come to a point where you have to use violence. But because if you have that conviction, absolutely you will come to a point where you have to use violence, then you will be looking, is this the right moment? And you will be anticipating already what might be possible along the road, and you will anticipate. And we have examples of that in Latin America too, for example, in Bolivia, when Che Guevara came back because he had the experience in Cuba, and now, well, the time is ready for that kind of change, revolutionary change. Went to Bolivia and kind of thought the whole people will join and so on. And, of course, it was a total failure. It had not really developed out of the whole process, but it was a kind of anticipation because of the idea that you had. But nevertheless, I think many other examples are kind of along the road. And sometimes I think violence and non-violence, they interplay in some way. The example you brought of the Philippines, I think I would see it in a little bit different way. I think the Philippines was and continues to be already a society which is divided, and with a strong guerrilla movement going on. So now the kind of the non-violent is not the looking of a possibility before the resort of a violence, but is in the face of groups that are using already violence, what can we do as an alternative? And so I think many, many motivations played a role in the Philippines. Some very noble ones, probably convictions of non-violence. But I think the role that the United States, for example, played, always supporting Ferdinand Marcos, but then suddenly supporting a change, was not because of conviction of non-violence, but it was because of the threat. What is going to happen if this radicalization goes on? So looking for some middle road, and that was a very decisive source for the possibility of the change in the Philippines. So I'm kind of arguing in favor of that these are processes which go on, and you cannot always anticipate what is going to happen.
No, I don't have any problem with what you're saying about the process. What I have a problem with is the theory of just war, which I consider to be simply theory, because I don't think it's possible, given human nature. And, you know, it's only possible if everybody plays by the rules. As far as I know, that's never going to happen. When you have war as a possibility. Now, I don't have a problem with, I know it's complicated, there's complicated issues, it's hard to make the decision when somebody's on your doorstep going to kill your family, you know, what are you going to do? Those are hard issues. I don't have a problem with calling a spade on that level. I have a problem with saying, well, there's certain conditions here that we're all going to play by these rules, and this is called jester, or I have a problem with that.
Oh, I have a lot of problems with that. But it's the majority Christian tradition, which I've tried to respect, and it's in the Augsburg Confession. So you ought to try to respect it. What is the human dignity of people who say that so unrealistically? Well, for one thing, they're idealists. They're utopians. They're not pragmatic, as they would sometimes claim to be, precisely because they make that claim. But it is possible to believe that you will fight fairly instead of unfairly. Some of my colleagues at Notre Dame in the ROTC program teach their students never shoot the prisoners. If I say that, they won't believe it. But if the colonel says that, they'll believe it. And one of these colonels has come back from Vietnam where he was involved in making sure that people got prosecuted who committed atrocities. So it isn't quite the case, in the best performance of the United States Armed Forces, that nobody cares about keeping the rules. There are some honest officers that care about keeping the rules. And there were honest officers under Hitler who cared about keeping the rules, who didn't kill their prisoners in North Africa. So that, although I am, as a pacifist, tend to be cynical about the whole business, that includes loving my enemies, and some of my enemies believe in the just war, so I have to affirm their integrity. So it is possible to claim that you can use some violence and not sell out to nothing but violence. And if it isn't possible, then you'll want to become pacifists. Or else admit that you're the rambles. And that's the ongoing conversation. But my conviction is that there are at least some people who do see their resort to violence as regrettable, conditioned in a situation where they tried other things first, where they have clarified that the goal is itself a desirable goal, and in fact a peace that would be better than the peace they would have if they didn't fight. And the discipline that those people are committed to is better than no discipline. Although it tends to have difficulty in keeping things from running away from them, with themselves, especially if the weapons used are more than manual. If you limit that kind of a conflict to what people can do with their own bodies and guns they have in their own hands, then it doesn't escalate so uncontrollably. But even then, it can get worse and worse if the hostilities go on and somebody doesn't lose right away.
Let's take a couple more quick questions.
So far we're talking global and national type issues. Bring something closer. How can you apply some of these things to something more personal, like if somebody were to be threatening physical harm to you or one of your family members, or if not physical harm, maybe some other sort of verbal violence or violating your integrity in some other way.
John, how do you treat the relationship between that kind of interpersonal realm and quiet?
Well, there'd be two kinds of things, or three kinds of things to say. When I was in university in Basel, one of our senior professors was the French Lutheran, Oscar Kuhlmann, who on almost every question would respond, "Haven't Sie mein Buch gelesen?" Have you read my book? I wrote a book on that subject. I don't know whether they have it in the bookstore because it wasn't published by Oxford. One thing I would say is that that is not representative of war. That kind of circumstance is spontaneous, immediate, and my response has to be that. You can never have a spontaneous war. You only have a war because you make institutional preparations. It takes money, it takes training, it takes weapons. War is an institutional phenomenon. It is not self-defense against a crazy or a brutal invader in the household. In that sense, it's fundamentally different. Secondly, if I were to defend my household against an insane or a brutal invader, there would be no problem of non-combatant immunity, no problem of escalation, no problem of legitimate authority, because I would be defending my own household, and that's legal to do. And I wouldn't kill anybody but that person. I wouldn't go to his house and kill his family. So again, it's nothing like war. But thirdly, I would still think that the norm in that setting, I don't know what I would do in terms of my own male psychology, but the proper thing to do would be to say in pious terms what God did when his son was being killed. Is not intervene otherwise than in the way of the cross. It might mean that I die instead of my family member. It might mean that nobody would have to die because creatively I could disarm the person by, if he's crazy, I should know better psychology than he. The one thing that I couldn't do would be to outshoot him if he had a gun and I had a gun, because he's probably a better shot than I am. So there's no case for violence in that hypothetical setting that I can see. Chances would be best pragmatically for some other outcome if I weren't set up to kill him. In fact, the police reports, records say that more people in America are killed by family members who have guns to protect them against intruders than are killed by intruders. So it's the notion that that's a prototypical situation that represents the violence problem is itself a part of the myth of a society that makes violence an idol.
Well, one of the other examples I was getting at was if it were not physical violence, but maybe somebody in your community had it in for you and wanted to, say, take over your property through some legal means or something like that, or somehow other do you in. That would be sort of a, at least closer, it wouldn't be the instantaneous type situation you'd have to face. That would be a longer term thing where it's premeditated and all.
Yeah, well, then I would see authentic reasons for my love for that person, including trying to keep that person from doing injustice to himself and to me, by using whatever means there were to keep that evil design from being carried out. But I wouldn't shoot him. And I wouldn't do to him what he's trying to do to me. I would try to find more humane means of carrying on the conflict.
One or two other brief questions. I have to call.
Be correct to surmise that even by a just war theory, to arm with nuclear weapons is just simply immoral. You simply cannot justify that in any way.
Walter, why don't you? Maybe agreement here.
Almost everybody who tries to use the just war tradition in any honest way says that. The World Council of Churches has said it. 83 at Vancouver. The Roman Catholic Bishops of the United States said it in 1983. The Lutheran World Federation almost said it in Budapest in 84. The Methodist Bishops have said it more recently. Any full-scale nuclear hostilities are sure to do more harm than good, whatever you measure it by, whether it's non-combatant immunity or the ecosystem or anything else. What remains open is whether you can threaten to use these weapons without using them and keep that threat credible enough that it can have some kind of deterrent effect and still not be morally responsible for what the use would do. And that Catholic bishops are still debating, and of course the Pentagon's on the other side. But I can't see that argument is morally credible, except in the backhanded sense. Richard Nixon told Kissinger, "I want the Chinese to think I'm crazy." I don't want to communicate rationality and mutuality and negotiation. I want to communicate fright so that they'll say they're willing to accept a detente to keep us from destroying them. If you want to commute craziness, communicate craziness, then nuclear deterrence is the way to do it. But rationally, we can't possibly do that. You can't have a credible threat system which will be carried out if they trigger it by doing the wrong things, and not be morally responsible for destroying the ecosystem and the city of Moscow. So anybody who thinks just war straight agrees that that's not possible.
Walter, comment?
Yeah, I think this is a good question for us Lutherans, because as mentioned, Luther did use the just war concept, and on the other hand, if we were looking about a revolutionary movement by the people, Luther denied that. Just a couple of remarks which could be pointing to another direction, but usually, and especially in relation to the Peasants' War, and so he always denied that kind of use of violence, while on the other hand, again, the state as using violent death penalty and so on was appropriate in the view of Luther. So that poses quite a bit of problems for us in our tradition. I think one point is really that nuclear weapons stand as a symbol here for a change in the nature of war in relation to what Luther knew. The nature of the weapons made possible wars limited to the extent of those weapons for Luther. So he could not contemplate the possibility of a weapon that would endanger the whole creation. So there is a fundamental change in the nature of war, which makes the concept of the just war obsolete in that context. And I think looking to the other question now of possible use of revolutionary violence as a last resort or so, I think there has been a fundamental change since Luther in the way we perceive society and the organization of society. Luther saw it hierarchical, organized, while we perceive societies as constituted by the people. So the authorities are not as representatives from God and legitimate for such, but the people constitute them, and therefore also the nature of revolutions has changed since Luther. That makes it both issues necessary for us Lutherans to rethink in a different context.
Thank you. I'm going to have to call a halt at this point, and I'd like to do it with a comma and not a period, if possible. John obviously is going to be continuing his series on the question of war and developing theological responses to those questions for the rest of this week, and Walter will be helping us think through questions of structural change and touching on a variety of viewpoints that come out of liberation theology through the week. I hope that both of those continuing sessions and the rest of our conversations during the week can keep these important discussions alive. Thank you.